Welcome to the Legal Moves Podcast. This is Zachary Strebeck, your host and resident game lawyer. Today, we are talking to game developer Robert Curry from Dinosaur Polo Club. Welcome, Robert.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Thanks for coming on. Can you introduce yourself a little bit? Where are you located? What is your game? Why are you on this show? That kind of stuff.
Sure thing. Yeah, so I am Robert Curry from Dinosaur Polo Club. We're a very small independent studio based in Wellington, New Zealand. We've been around for about 3 years now, and we're still working on our first game, Mini Metro. We released on Steam November last year, and we're currently working on our iOS and Android releases.
Excellent. So what is your background? Where did you how did you get into the game industry?
Right. I've always been into games. I think I got my first computer at 13. But even before then, my brother and I, Peter, were still just playing, you know, board games and anything we could find. So from the age of 13, we actually had access to a PC, which we just played lots of games on, Civilization, doing, that kind of stuff.
Awesome.
And then just started tinkering around and then, went to university, and kind of the obvious thing was a computer science degree. So we both did those. I kind of was a year behind. I thought I'd do something else and got into marketing, but that wasn't my thing. So I kind of then followed my brother into computer science as well. And then he got a job at a local game studio. There's like one here in that was, 15 years ago, there was kind of one that had been going for 5 years called She Interactive. Mm-hmm. They're actually still here now. So they're just turning 20 next year, I think, which is huge.
Yeah, actually, I think I tried to get a job with them, it was 15 years ago, 12 years ago, something like that, when I'm still trying to work in games. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. Jeez, that's interesting.
It didn't work, obviously, but yeah. I did try. Yeah.
Oh, wow. He got a job there, and then I kind of started hanging out with them, and then ended up getting a job a year afterwards. Pete spent 4.5 years there, and I was there for 3.5 years, and then we left in 2006 with a fellow game developer there to go indie. So this was back in 2006, 2008. We didn't last very long. We were aiming to do an MMO with three people. It does sound dopey, and I guess it was quite ambitious, but at that stage, that was sort of before the App Store and before sort of independent games had kind of, before there was an obvious path to market for smaller teams. And there were a small set of small scale MMOs with maybe a few thousand players, which were all kind of done by teams of maybe 1 to 5. So
it's more of MMO than a MMO, part maybe isn't
exactly
in there.
Exactly. Yeah. It's still kind of a persistent world and everything, but
very cool.
The scope was a lot smaller. But still, I mean, we were just so clueless. We didn't really know how to get
You know what? That's not an uncommon problem.
No,
for new developers.
They bite
off more than they can chew. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Since then, I kind of went to web development, and my brother went into app development, and then we just entered a game jam a few years ago just to, hang out on a weekend, and then we came up with the game we're selling now. So, and then that sort of led to professional indies. So, yeah, that's how that went.
That's great. So do you have like a formal company or a business entity, or are you just sort of working as a partnership?
No, we do. We've always known that's a very important thing to get right.
Is that an easy process in New Zealand? I don't really know how it works there.
Yeah. I mean, I've only had experience inside New Zealand, but from what I hear, it's pretty simple. You head to the companies.gov.nz website, type in your name. Hopefully it's free, pay $100, and there you go. You're done.
Very cool.
There's a little bit of bookkeeping you need to do. I think every year you need to hold a director's meeting and make sure that there's a unanimous decision to not get audited, which, funnily enough, almost everybody does. And and then you have to file that, and that's about it. But besides that, it's pretty easy.
Okay. Yeah. Is it like an LLC? I don't know what you would call them there, but here we
go. It's a limited liability company.
Yep.
Yeah, so the same thing, but they're called LTD instead of LLC. But everyone understands that a GmbH and an LLC and an LTD and all that are the same things.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, you can call yourselves LTD. It just means limited, right?
Totally fine. Okay. it's just always a thing. I assume that LLC means you're an American company, and you know,
maybe. Yeah. I mean, you can. It's just like the indicia of corporate existence or something like that that you have to put at the end of a company name, just so they know that what they're looking at is an actual company, a limited liability entity.
Otherwise, you only ever see LTD if you saw LTD. Right.
Yeah, here you can sort of choose anything that means that. So you have a wide selection.
I don't know if you're allowed to pick anything else, but everyone always does LTD.
Interesting. Yeah, I think LLC looks the best. So, I mean, you can write a limited liability company and write it out. It's just kind of ridiculous. It doesn't fit on a box or whatever very well.
Yeah, for sure.
So you're not doing this full time, or are you?
No,
it sounds like you're doing freelance web development and other jobs.
Oh, no, that's what we did do to kind of pay the bills.
Okay.
I got into the web industry and I didn't do games at all for probably 3 years. So right now we are completely full time. The game funds the development on it. So we are very fortunate to have to kind of get in on that, you know, and not have to go through any sort of, you know, equity, you know, looking for equity and stuff like that. For funding. So I can't remember where I was going with that. So, however, even though we are paid, there is some stuff we do on the side that we don't really get paid for anything. That's kind of more community stuff. So we're helping organize a local games festival, which just ran last week.
That's great. How did that go? So tell me about that. That's great.
Yeah. So that was called Play by Play, and it's playbyplay.co.nz. So that was a week-long festival that we ran. It had a week-long exhibition of local games, all developed inside New Zealand. And then there was a conference that we ran as well on the Saturday, and then followed by the first New Zealand Video Game Awards. Mm-hmm. So that went really well, but I think it's the thing we have to sort of factor into our business plan, is that how much time it takes. Right. I don't think we quite budgeted how... I think we had an unrealistic expectation of how long it would actually take to get off the ground. So for the last 6 weeks, we haven't been doing any work at all. That was partially due to GDC, and then we went to England as well for London Games Festival. But it is a thing we need to think about how much time we're prepared to put into the non-paying community stuff and how much time we need to actually spend on the game. Because once the game stops making, you know, once it stops selling, we're not going to have any time at all to... give. So
well, if you don't want investors in the game, maybe it'd be good to take donations or something like that for the festival. I don't know. There's gotta be some way to make it self-sustaining, so at least maybe you're paying yourself for that time.
It definitely does like, yeah, we do need to, we did seek sponsorship, but it's very hard in your first year. We did almost break even.
That's great.
It was a very good success though, so we're hoping that next year it's not going to be so much of an issue,
right,
that we'll be able to head to sponsors and say, you know, this is what we did. It was a success. Would you like to be part of it next year? So
great. So tell me a little bit about the New Zealand game industry now that you've sort of gotten a picture of it from doing this festival.
Right. Yeah. So it's been around for a long time in some form or the other. I think the thing that we generally, I guess I should say there are probably about 500 people employed in the industry. Now, put in perspective, we're a country of 4.5 million.
Right. That's a lot.
So yeah, I think it's about the size of Colorado, I think. I remember comparing it to a state, and I think that was the state we were most like.
Okay.
So yeah, we've got several big companies, some of which are quite long established. What we're seeing now is kind of, which I think is the same everywhere, is an explosion in the independent space. Mm-hmm. So we've had quite a few sort of medium-sized successes like our studio, and that I think the big thing is in the next few years is seeing where those go. So we're hoping to expand to a small studio, perhaps about five or so. Because I think that's where the main growth is going to be in the next few years. Having said that, we have got, there's a big studio here in Wellington. We've got the Weta Workshop has a studio that is producing games for the Magic Leap AR device.
Yeah. Right.
There's a big studio Grinding Gear Games, which is they've been developing their own action RPG, which has been highly successful for the last about 8 years, I think. And they've got an employee rating of about 55, I think they have there. Yeah, there's a studio down in called Digital Confectioners with a successful multiplayer game on Steam called Depth. So I think it's still an industry small enough that probably everyone knows all the studios and everything like that. But it does seem to be expanding every day, which is great.
That's awesome. So it's just the two of you, you and your brother now?
Yeah, well, full time it's us. Okay. We have an artist that works probably 2 or 3 days a week on it as well. And we had an audio guy, Disaster Piece. He did all the audio for it. He's not involved so much these days, but he was involved heavily early last year.
Very cool. No, he's you know, sort of famous for working in games, right? Soundtrack, right?
Yes. Okay. We did approach him because we wanted to. We had a very unique. We had a very solid idea about what we wanted for the audio, and we wanted it to be a very completely procedural audio, so that everything you did in the game had an effect on the audio, and that's the kind of thing that he loves to do and is very well known for. So we just asked him in the hope, you know, maybe he would, and he completely did. Awesome. I think it was one of, I think we got a pretty good. Because, you know, he loves that. So he really loved to just experiment with it and to give things a go. So it was really, I think, the best thing for him to work on at the time. And he was the best person for us to have on it. So it was great. It was great. Right. And, I mean, we did manage to pick up the idea for audio. So I think that kind of shows the work that he put into it, which was great.
Excellent. So about the game, let's talk about the game a bit.
Yeah.
Mini Metro. So it has a really unique, obviously unique audio style, but the graphic style is also unique. Was it influenced by, I guess, Metro city maps and things like that?
Yeah, completely. That's basically where we get all of our inspiration from for the game design and the game look here. So when we had this game jam in May 2013, I'd had a couple of ideas kicking around my head, and one was because I'd just been to England and I found an interesting part of each day was to work out how to get from A to B and so if I want to head to this museum here, I have to catch this line here and then an exchange on this line. And so the idea I had for this game jam was that you would have a map and then you would have to get from A to B and pick like which line to jump on and then where to hop off and things. And then Peter said, you know, it'd be more interesting if you built the map. And then that was basically it. We just then kind of talked for half an hour about, you know, what we could do how we could make how we could keep it looking like a map, but have it editable and what the game mechanics would be. And nothing's really changed since in about 3 years' time. Yeah.
So how quickly did you have a prototype up and running from that idea stage to getting something where you could actually play it and show it?
Yeah, well, this was in the LD jam, so we had 3 days to do it. We did it in 2.5 because it starts at the same time everywhere in the world. So for us, it was like Saturday at 10, which isn't really the best time to start because I think it's meant to start Pacific time or Eastern time, I think. It's meant to start at like Friday at 8, which is a much better time. So I had to head into work on Monday, so we had like two full days and then that was about it. So we got the game running on Sunday afternoon and then tested it a bit and then chucked in some audio Monday lunchtime and called it done then. So yeah, that was it. And then from there we had a really good reception from the audience, and then we just thought, oh, perhaps we should get it out on an iPad in a few weeks, and but that was, you know, 3 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're still going.
Well, how early into the process did you start? Did you put it on Steam Early Access or any other place where people play early?
Yeah, we had it free on our website since ever, so I don't think it's ever been off our website.
Okay.
And we found that a really good validation tool. So just people giving it a go, seeing if it was any good, and if they would come back to it, like that's when you kind of know it's got legs. However, we were getting maybe 5 to 10 hits a day, just friends and friends, you know, that's about it. It's wasn't anybody else sort of getting hit to it. We got it to a stage where we put it onto Steam Greenlight. Mm-hmm. That was when it exploded. Like at that point there, it found some mainstream press on The Verge, I think. And then from there it went to Kotaku, it's Moto, and just like everywhere. It just went completely, yeah. It seemed to be the entire internet for a few days.
That's going to be overwhelming, yeah?
You got everyone. It was, yeah, it really was. I mean, yeah. Pete was the main sort of, he was the main contact. And I think we went to his house the next day and just being next to his computer and just seeing his constant, you know, email, Twitter, email was just incredible. So then our hits went to about 30,000 a day. On the website, and that's when we thought, right, obviously this is a thing. And at that stage we were both still part-time. Pete had done a lot more on it than I had. And then he decided to go full-time. He was actually halfway through a job interview process at Magic Leap when he was like, when this thing happened, he's like, maybe I should give this a go. So he had to turn that job down and went on that full-time. Yeah, and then I came on full-time a few months after that because I had a pretty good job and I was still weighing up my options, which took me about 6 months to decide one way or the other.
That's cool. So you just put it up on Greenlight. Did you send it out to anyone or anything like that? Or did they just somehow pick it up?
We didn't. We put it up on Greenlight and then I'm trying to think how. Oh, so we'd use this sort of 2D Unity mm-hmm. module done by Matt Ricks, who was the guy that did Trainyard, which was a highly successful iOS game from a few years earlier than that. Mm-hmm. And he liked it and he mentioned it. And then we think that's how it got out. Honestly, we did no marketing or anything like that. We didn't really think about it at all. I mean, I think we used it more as a validation tool rather than a marketing tool. Mm-hmm. So we didn't actually attempt to push people into it, but people just found it anyway. So I think that was the point when we realized, okay, we don't even need to market this. Like it just sort of does itself.
What do you think about the game that does that?
Honestly, I think it's a couple of things. One is that it's the only game that really does what it does. I think that's not true. I think any game where you build things and watch a network work, they're always very satisfying just on their own, like because you just set this thing up and then it just works and you get to watch it. I think that's a very satisfying thing, and it's a thing that not many games do. Just games like Factorio, the Settlers, things like that. Another thing is that it doesn't look like a game, it really appeals non-gamers. Like what we find at cons is that often the spouses that get hauled along to PAX like wear the game that they want to, that they like the way it looks, and then they get into it and they like the way it plays as well. So I think it has an easy appeal to non-gamer audiences, which is the thing I think that as most game developers are gamers themselves, we easily miss. And it's a thing that we didn't plan on making a game like that. I think we just happened to fall into it, but it's now a thing that we've seen how powerful that can be, is that if you just make a game that people recognize, like most people know what the map is and they understand what kind of gameplay it'll have, or at least a rough idea. So they don't have to learn it from scratch. Like, whereas if you get a non-traditional gamer looking at like any hardcore game, but it's like, that's just a game. I'm not going to mention that.
Yes. Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, one of the games that I like to play, and I'm not very good at it, but I enjoy it, is a game called Space Cam. Have you played that? You're sort of building a machine. It's sort of the same thing you were talking about before, where I like to do that, but I don't think I'm very good at them. And I wasn't very good at Mini Metro either. I'll say that now.
Space Cam is certainly, I mean, yeah, that certainly scratches the same itch, but it's a lot more difficult to get into.
Absolutely.
You know, it does ask a lot more of you. Whereas what we found with that game is that people can have fun, and then you ask them afterwards about it, and then you from what they're saying, you understand they don't actually know what's going on, but they had fun anyway, you know? Yeah.
So did you have it like maybe a more complex game at some point and you've sort of stripped away some complexity, or was it always pretty simple?
Not from this game. No, this game was always designed to be this straightforward. We have worked on much more complicated games.
Right.
I mean, ever since Pete and I have been building games since from the age of 15 or so. Right. And they were always just completely overblown, you know, RPGs or strategy games or whatnot. And this was the first time, because this was the first time that we thought about what the kind of game was that we could actually get done.
Okay.
And because, you know, it was just us, no artists, no audio, anything. We thought, right, we have to make a game that has, you know, no asset requirements, right, small scope. And then we did, and then it managed to be quite successful. So I think that's the thing, is that this was the first time we actually thought about a realistic scope.
I think that's extremely important for other indie developers to pay attention to, right? Is what can you actually finish, right? What kind of game? And here it even took you, it's taken you years still, right? And you purposely limited the scope and it's still taking a long time. So, you know, no, it's not any fault of yours, but it's just the reality of game development sometimes.
That's how long things take. Exactly. Yeah. Things take a very long time.
So imagine if you were trying to do an MMO or an RPG. I mean, I have clients that approach me with games that are way outside of what they could potentially do by themselves or even with a small team. And we have to have a talk and just say, hey, you know, you're not going to be able to finish this game. You should really start, even whether it's board games or it's video games, I mean, or mobile apps. I mean, they all kind of, everyone thinks big and that's great, but you really have to limit yourself, especially for your first game or two or three.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because I think it's important to get in the habit of actually starting things you can finish.
Yes. I mean, and that's finishing things you started, I think.
I mean, I shouldn't say, you know, don't be ambitious, but do be realistic with yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And if you haven't finished a game before, just trust me, stick small. I can remember back in maybe 2007 when we were still had our MMO idea and we kind of had realized how it wasn't really going to happen. It was under like 5 years time.
Right.
We just stripped everything back to what we could get as an MVP, and we were still looking down at like a year's development before we had like two spaceships flying around. Wow. And we're just like, hang on a minute, this is just crazy. We must be doing something wrong. And I think we were thinking that we were doing things wrong with our time frame rather than wrong with our scope.
Right.
But it took a long time of doing that type of attempts before we worked out, no, we're the ones doing it wrong. Like, we need to shift the scope, not the.
It's interesting because, like, when I grew up, I would read about Richard Garriott, Lord British, creating Ultima 1 through 3, like in his garage or whatever, and it's just like him and he's programming it himself, or he just has a couple of people helping him, and these are like huge games, and you think, maybe that inspires people to want to do these kind of things themselves, but it's just impossible, especially now.
I think the fidelity is the problem because we were coming off sort of console type, you know, PS2, Xbox, that kind of stuff, and we could not reduce down the fidelity of the game. Like, it had to match that.
Right.
And as an indie developer, that's just death. Like, you cannot compete with that level of presentation.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
I think
presentation, yeah.
I think these days you probably can compete on that degree, but not the current,
but not on the current generation. Gen,
it's just like you always have to be kind of one gen behind, or you can focus on one specific thing, but you're not going to have the best of everything.
Sure. Well, like when you said, you should still be ambitious, but you have to keep it within your scope. Yeah, you can. Like a big game, like an MMO, is ambitious in 20 different ways, right? There's the ambitious size of the world, ambitious depth of character leveling or powers or something. So if you're an indie game, maybe you're ambitious about one thing. Like for yours, it's maybe the strategy of creating the Metro, right? And that's where you're ambitious. Yeah.
So our kind of thing now that we kind of tell people, well, not tell people, but say this is a thing that I think I would have loved to have known when I was your age, is like pick one thing in your game that you know you can't do yet, but you would like to learn how to do. Everything else, make sure you can do that because you will find things that you can't do anyway, and you'll have to you'll have to figure them out regardless.
You don't want 20 so don't of those things,
it,
right?
Yeah, no. Don't make it too hard on yourself out of the gates.
Absolutely. Yeah. So is this type of game, I've played board games that are like Mini Metro kind of, where you're setting up rails, like Rail and Tycoon and other pickup and deliver games, they call them. Because you're here in Mini Metro, you're sort of moving passengers, right, along their correct
path. So you build the routes that passengers use to get to where they want to go. Yeah, yeah.
Is that the type of board game that you like, or do you have any experience with this type of game before?
Honestly, no.
It's okay to say no.
I'm much more of a strategy
board
gamer and strategy gamer. I think, again, it just comes down to sort of what the scope was that we picked. Like, we do feel kind of a fraud sometimes because we have a very big following of Metro enthusiasts.
Uh-huh.
And I think people expect us to be really passionate about, you know, Metro systems and public transport and trains, and we're like, they're all right.
Right. That's like, there's a podcast called Startup. I don't know if you know that podcast, but they talked about a guy who made a ton of money making a Spanish language Bible, and the guy A, doesn't speak Spanish, and B, is an atheist. So he's like, it's like his fans of that company, it probably expect him to be something that he's completely not. So I understand.
Yeah, it's funny that like you get this expectation that you are like your fans, I guess. But obviously that's not always the case.
Or maybe that your next game is going to be maybe a more detailed train simulator or something.
Yeah,
like that.
We have talked about kind of capitalizing on Mini Metro and doing a much more in-depth sim. But on the other hand, we're like, maybe it doesn't involve trains at all.
How about space? I like space. I would play a space game. Yeah. I don't know. So I first met you at PAX Prime, I think. I came by the booth there.
Yes, it was at PAX Prime, yeah.
I don't know if you remember me, but yeah, definitely. And I think, were you at PAX South? Or it might have been at GDC recently. I saw like the back of your head. I saw your booth, but I actually never went over there. You were sort of across the room from me.
Yeah, we were at GDC this year. Okay, sure, great. Yeah.
So are those the only two, besides your own convention that you just had in New Zealand, are there any other? Oh, and you were just in London, you said, right?
Yeah, we were. It was kind of a drop of a hat thing. We were unexpectedly in for the BAFTAs. Okay. So we were like, sweet, we're going to head there. This was the week before we were supposed to be organizing our own festival, so that made things a little bit more complicated. So we were there for almost all of London Games Festival, which included a few little independent games shows, VR Summits and EGX Res, which was kind of like a PAX, but a lot smaller. Yeah.
Do you find that going to these events provides a lot of value for you or for the marketing the game?
It's a thing we probably don't take as much advantage of as we should, because they're expensive for us to get to, you know, to head over the Pacific is a few thousand dollars each. So I think the main use of them is seeing people's reactions and responses to the game, like to understand if, you know, the kind of people that you're pulling in, the kind of people that you're turning away, and just to get a large amount of people thrashing your game. You know, that's the very useful part of it. And you see the same issues coming up time after time after time, you know, and you're like, maybe that's my fault and I should fix that, you know. So that's a great use of it. The other thing is just meeting people. I mean, you just meet so many other developers and industry professionals, like yourself.
Podcasters.
And so, I mean, we've met so many other developers that we're now in touch with. And just sort of be, I think, especially being in the indie mega booth as well, that kind of gets you, as much as you hate to say there's this sort of in a circle or anything like that, it does get you contacts and you can talk with all the other alumni and things like that, which is very helpful. Definitely. Like, so, I mean, we can just email each other about, you know, issues with, so, you know, we can say, okay, is this publisher any good, like, you know, has anyone experience with these guys, or I want to get my game into Japan, how do I do that? And you just get everyone answering you and say, oh, well, you know, I did this and I did that and da da da. So it really is helpful to meet other developers, just so you have other people to ask about that kind of stuff. Because I think all too often what happens is people have to learn the same things again and again and again.
Yeah.
And when you get in these kind of networks, you can kind of shortcut that. And I mean, it's not like anyone resents that they had to do things the hard way and now they're just basically handing anyone else an easy path, because it seems like everyone's on the same team when you're a developer. Because I think, it was explained to me quite well by an Australian developer, is that it's not like if you buy my game, you can't buy anyone else's game. Like, everyone's buying games. So you
don't own a zero-sum game.
Basically. Yeah. So you don't only have one game.
Yeah, and if anything, it's sort of symbiotic, right? So you're following one developer, and then they say, hey, I'm playing this game now. Maybe they're blogging or whatever, or they're on Twitch or something. And they show your game, and now your game gets a huge bump, and you can sort of work together. It works like that in Kickstarter, too. A lot of Kickstarters cross-promote each other.
Kickbacks and stuff like that. Sure.
Yeah, the community, and I think even more so in board games, I think the community is great.
Developers
all work with each other.
The other thing I think is, especially when you're coming from a remote location, is that everyone is generally at these things, and you can meet people like, you know, Apple and Microsoft and Sony and whatnot, and they'll always have people there. So you really have to just harangue everybody you can and say, I want to meet up to discuss this and this. So it's kind of like, once you average out the cost per meeting, it's actually pretty, you know, that at that point it isn't that expensive, and it would probably cost you more to not go to the big ones. So I imagine we're going to be at GDC every year. PAX only when we have a game to I don't think we get that much out of it if we didn't have a game to actually have on the shop floor. And then there's also the one in the PAX Australia as well, which I think we'll be heading to every year, because that's only maybe $300 to get there and back.
When is that? That's in November or something?
It's in November. Yeah.
I may actually be around there. Maybe I'll go this year. I think I might be in I'll be in October. I'll be in Germany for the Eschenspiel.
Nice.
Convention. And then, I don't know, I was going to go back to Japan maybe, but maybe I'll come down to Australia. I'm afraid of Australia because I am a huge snake and spider phobic. So I've heard nothing but horrible things.
We like to think that is about them as well, because I mean we don't have any harmful animals at all in New Zealand, and they just have the lion's share of them.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a thing that they like to kind of scare us about and say, oh, well, there was a spider I once saw that was this big, and then but I've been over there maybe 5-6 times. I haven't ever seen anything poisonous. I don't go outside of the of the urban environments much, but
yeah, neither do I.
Definitely
not in Australia. I think I'm literally having daytime nightmares about spiders right now. talking about it, it's freaking me out.
Sorry about that.
No, it's fine.
Moving along. Anyway.
So, was there ever any plan to use Kickstarter or something like that to fund this game, or were you just always going to kind of bootstrap it and do it on your own?
Yeah, we never really talked about that. I think we may have talked about it very early, but we never. Because I think it was at the point where we knew what effort was involved to get one of those up and running, how it's like a month long.
It's a huge month. Months and months. It could be 6 months. Yeah, so it's a huge thing. Yeah.
I don't think we were ever kidding ourselves that it wouldn't be more work than it would get in.
Maybe in the old days you could just throw one up there and it'd be fine, but now
I think the expectation is very high. And honestly, I think the perception of how much games cost is very low.
Absolutely.
So I think it works better for board games than it does for video games.
Yeah.
Because board games you can get completely done and then say, look, I've got this thing done. I just have to get like, you know, five.
Yeah, basically that's how it works. Because the work is done after the money comes in because it's basically going into physical goods. With video games, we have to develop this. I mean, you may have a prototype or something like that, but
development happens after. For video games, it can really give people just enough rope to hang themselves with because, you know, you can spend it all on what you see you were going to do and not you know, fritter it away or anything.
Yep.
But then realize that you completely underestimated and now you've got you know, 5,000 people are like, hey, where's my game? And you're like, well, I kind of money.
And that has happened. I mean, there have been some high profile projects that have just sort of went under completely.
Exactly. And I know that's what everybody thought would happen at some point, and it has. So, yeah. So I don't, I mean, we'd have to, it isn't like we've ever ruled it out, but we know going into that we would have to have a lot of thought about how much it's going to cost, what can we expect to get, at, you know, to get, and what can we expect to give. And yeah, it's definitely one that we would approach with much trepidation.
Right.
No, I mean, I think at the point now we can self-fund for a while. So
that's good.
It's a good place to be at. It's just absolutely. That you know that we're being able to risk our own cash instead of everyone else's, I think it's a good place to have, at least that we have that option. Yeah.
Yep. What about the government? I know there are some countries where the government will sort of offer some sort of financial assistance.
Yeah, for game we hear stories of these countries.
These mythical lands like, I don't know, I think Finland might be one of them. I don't know.
Yeah, Canada. Yeah. Australia is very, very good, actually. Huh. They poach a great deal of New Zealanders because New Zealanders are like, man, that's a sweet deal.
Exactly, it's a great deal. I wish we'd do it here.
We have got some government support. It's not huge, but it's more about sending people to GDC, that kind of thing. The NZGDA, the New Zealand Game Developers Association, they're working very hard to, I mean, they have been for 15 years or so to try to show that the games industry is a big thing inside New Zealand and it could be big. And they're working on getting government funding. Which, from what I hear, it's going reasonably well, but you don't even know how these things will end up. What we find here is that the film industry here is huge, obviously, and it's a thing that we're very well known for. And games tend to be lumped in with film, at least here. And film is a lot easier to sell politically than games are because, you know, film. Everyone watches films. It's a lot easier to say, look, we've got a cool film industry than it is to say about your games industry. At least that's the image that we have of games here.
Yeah.
So I think a great deal of the work that we attempt to do is to try and promote the image of the games industry and get games so that it becomes more politically viable to support it. So I would think within the next 2 to 5 years that we will have a more fleshed out government support of games, but right now it's bitsy, and I mean you can get like R&D grants and things like that, but it can be a great deal of work, and generally most people are like, I don't want to worry about it.
I wonder if that kind of stuff generally goes to maybe bigger companies as well, like not a two-man shop that's going to get that.
Just because the paperwork requirements, it's not that they're onerous or anything, it's just that they can be quite intimidating for people that aren't familiar with it. But once you're a much more established outfit, it makes more sense to have a look at that stuff. Yeah,
or you can pay people like me, like a lot of very small or new startup indie developers just can't afford to have a lawyer, but that's the time when you most need the lawyer, right?
I know, it's such a weird thing,
I mean, I guess you could blame me for charging money, but that's well, I need to eat as well.
Yeah, I don't think anyone can deny you the right to eat or anything, but it's funny. I mean, we did know that it was important to get that stuff sort of worked out, so we've got some IP protection that we paid for early on, and we get everything that we enter into, we always get checked first.
Great.
Which isn't, you know, which does cost, but it's will cost us more than it would if we did not do that.
The potential downside is much bigger, right?
We had the advantage that you know, that we weren't going into this like straight out of university or anything. We did have some funds that we could use to put into this. I mean, I think all up we probably sunk 10 grand in before we got anything back. So it's not a huge amount. Like it's not, it's a lot less than the time that we put into it at that point. But we are thankful here that we do have a very games friendly law firm, and that there's this one guy in particular, Tim Schumann, and he's very interested in the games industry, and we just point everyone to him in the area and just say, you know, this guy knows his business and everything. And he's just yeah, into games, in the games industry. And I'm pretty sure he charges us less than everyone else because I'm pretty sure.
We often do.
I'm pretty sure the stuff we get out of him, I'm like, it seems expensive still, but hearing how much other people say how much they pay, I'm sure this is like a third of what we should be paying.
You'd be surprised at how expensive lawyers can get. It's quite crazy. Yeah.
So I think guys such as yourself, I think, you know, that game developers do very value those sort of, you know, games friendly law firms and will always point everyone else to them. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned IP protection. What sort of IP protection have you gone through?
Right, we've got a registered trademark on Mini Metro in New Zealand, Australia, and America, I think. We got this early on, yeah. Uh-huh. And the EU, we have to get the EU done at some point, but that was a lot more expensive to get that one done.
I know a guy if you need to.
Oh, cool. Yeah, we have a firm here that seems to be all right. Okay. They seem really expensive. We're like, really? We pay this much? And then everyone was like, yeah, that's how much it is. Yeah. We're like, oh, okay. So it's kind of one thing to know that you're paying a lot, but it's one thing to know you're paying a lot, but that's, you're not being ripped off.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But it is one of those things as well that we hope we never have to find out if we've paid enough or not, because once we do, then we know we've going to get into, you know, vast law fights and stuff in courts around the world, and that's going to be vastly more expensive. So hopefully we won't have any of that.
You do have a Mini Metro trademark in the US. I'm looking at it now.
Oh, we do.
Just to reassure you, yes, it does exist.
Thank you very much. I just kind of thought I never actually had that independently confirmed. So.
It's right there on the internet. Don't worry. Anyone can check it. All right. So before we go, do you have maybe one more tip for new game developers? I know you gave one earlier that was pretty good, but that's maybe.
Oh, yeah, right. The thing we do a lot is don't – it's easier, and this makes kind of no sense, but it's easier as an independent game developer to be risky than not. Like, I mean, it is less risk to be risky. So don't do a safe game. Like, if you do a game that can be compared to anything else, you're probably doing... I mean, it's not that you're doing it wrong, but you have to fight harder.
Yes.
You know, our game is the only game of its type. You can see it instantly from a screenshot. You kind of know what it is. It explains itself in the screenshot and the game name. And that is worth gold. Like, just having a game that you don't need to explain very well. That, like, you can see it and you sort of have a rough understanding of it. That's a very, very good thing. And there was one other thing, and it's now just escaped me. But that was the main thing anyway.
Okay.
It's just basically make sure that your screenshot and your game name, if you see that, people will understand what your game is, because that's pretty much what 80% of your game, what your people are going to buy your game, are going to know about it before they buy it. And that's right. One more thing. Make sure that you don't oversell your game, so we find that people are turned off our game very easily from the screenshots. That's fine, because we don't want those people buying our game, because they won't like the game anyway.
Right.
So make sure that your game marketing and your game, like, sets up the expectations of your game.
Okay.
And so the only people who are buying your game are the people who will like your game, because those are two different things and you have to get them to match up. And that's a thing that we found we sort of lucked into, because we didn't ever intend that to happen, but we've sort of now analyzed it and we can see that's a thing. So that if people come into our booth because of they see the game's the game's presentation, they almost always like the game. In fact, probably 99% will just be like, oh my God, that was an amazing game, da da da.
Right.
Because everyone that didn't like it didn't even stop in the booth. They're just like, that game was boring. And honestly, they're completely right for them. So
sure, that's fine.
Just make sure those things line up. Yeah.
Well, if they don't play it, they're missing out. That's going to do it for this episode. Thank you for coming on the show, Robert.
Cool. Thanks for having me. Thanks very much.
So where can people find you? to buy the game.
Oh, right.
And to, check out
the easiest way is I'm at Shiprib on Twitter, and we're at Dino Apollo Club. You can check out the game on Steam or visit our website at dinoapolloclub.com/mini-metro.
Great. Me, you can find at gamelawyerblog.com and go on iTunes and put a 5-star review up there. And that's it for this week. So, Robert, thanks again, and I will talk to everyone next week.